Hello and welcome to Around the World. We are back. I'm Dylan. I'm here with Drags. And today joining us is Bjarni Theisen, coming over from Germany. Bjarni played for Holstein Kiel and made it as far as the reserves team, which play in the fourth tier in Germany, while the first team resides in the second tier currently. He then went to West Virginia, where he was a third-team All-American last season on a team that made it all the way to the Elite Eight, and he finished the season ranked as the number 26 player in America by the Top Drawer Soccer Top 100. He then is currently playing in the USL2, the fourth tier of American soccer, and got ranked by the league as the number 4 ranked prospect in the country. So, Bjarni, welcome. How are you doing, man?
Hey, I'm good. How are you? Thanks for the invitation.
No problem, man. No, we're really happy to have you here. You're killing the game right now. And so before we talk about anything soccer, I want you to – is it true that your dad invented a card game for your entire town?
Yeah, it's true. No, we got it in our hometown. I think I showed you when we were on vacation, right, in Mexico.
Yeah.
Like, it's basically a drinking game. And yeah, at the beginning, it's pretty simple. You just say a card, and whoever picks that card has to drink. That's pretty much the game. And the further it goes, the more cards you pick. Like, you show, like, oh, I got four to pick 10 cards because I don't care when I drink. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So it's literally it's just simple. A profusely hard drinking game, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's also a show of ego, if I remember correctly, because so I think it's something like you pick one card, let's say the Ace of Hearts, right? And you say that's your card, and then you put all 52 cards on the table, and you can grab one card and hope that, oh, it's not the Ace, and then you don't have to drink. But you know, the way that Bjarni was teaching us was you can grab like half the deck. And then you screw over the person next to you if you don't get that card.
So that's hilarious. No, that's great.
So Bjarni so has some the Thiessen family has ties into Kiel, Greater Kiel, Germany. A very important family over there.
Because of that, yeah.
That's hilarious. Well, yeah, thanks Bjarni again for joining us today. We're super excited. You have an awesome story. So I guess we'll just get right into it. So first we're just kind of wondering from a broad perspective, how the Kiel Academy system treated you when you were a young player. So kind of how was it growing up in that academy system? And what did you kind of get out of that?
I would say I had a pretty good time. Like, you have to see Kiel is like pretty the club where it's more like family, you know. You have that the big clubs like Bayern Munich and stuff, and everybody's kind of for their own and just hard working. And in Kiel, like family stuff. You could see like the locker rooms from under 17, under 19, under 23 are right next to the professional locker room, like in the same building. You see them every day. They say hello and stuff. Everybody's so nice to each other, and I think that's what Kiel is about. Like watching Kiel is about. And yeah, I came over there under 16 team and played, I think, 6 years to under 23.
Nice. Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. And you not only played in the academy, if I'm correct, you made it to the second team eventually, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so what was that experience like? I mean, it's one thing to be signed for the academy. That's still actually very, very impressive for a team like Kiel. It's in the second tier. But then to get promoted to the second team, to the reserve team, that's in the fourth tier, which is a high level over in Germany. What was that like for you?
I actually had a quite hard time in the second team because I barely played. I had like, I think, one starting experience, some subs in. When I came up in the second team, I was injured, I think, for 3 months. So I lost the whole preseason, and I never really got into the team in my first year. The year before, I got in the second team. They promoted in the fourth division, so a lot of players stayed. Then in the second team, also always the problem is that you get the players from the first team, right? If they don't play in the first team, you get them. And I remember there was one defender, and he was my year, and he just came from Schalke, signed for the first team, and he actually, you could tell he played every game in our team. So one spot was seeded, then another spot for the captain, then we had one, two more very good center backs, I have to say. And yeah, there was no place for me. But at the same time, I have to say, coach was always so fair to me. Like, they always gave me the chance to sub in. They talked to me and stuff. So I can't really be mad about them, you know what I mean? Because they were fair.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how was that for you, kind of dealing with that? That whole thing about kind of not getting as much playing time as you kind of anticipated. How was that for you mentally? How was that for like your development and things like that? How did you kind of get around maybe not getting as many minutes as you would have liked?
Yeah, the first year, as I said, I was injured for those first 3 months. So I told myself after winter, I want to come back, like preseason and winter for the second period of the season. Didn't work out that good, to be honest, but at the end, I got some games. So I got subbed in after 45 minutes and stuff. So I was quite hopeful, like, okay, it was my first season, men's level, it's different. It's just not the youth style anymore. It's more like long balls, heading, bodies, real man. And so yeah, after my first year, I thought, oh, okay, maybe in my second year, I get more chances. Cause now I got what men's level is about. And yeah, but it didn't start that good either in the second year. And then before winter, I was close to leave the club, to go to another fourth division club, also close to me, like 1 hour further away. And then we got some injuries and the coach told me, hey, I can't let you leave. That's basically the story. So I said, yeah, okay. If you say you can't let me leave, then you better play me in the second period. They wanted to leave in the winter. But then, yeah, COVID hit.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, that's tough. COVID definitely was a hitch in a lot of people's careers. But Bjorn, you mentioned, yeah, you understood eventually what men's soccer was all about compared to youth. Can you talk to us a little bit? I know you said physicality, but what's that jump like? Yeah, going from a youth, still have a professional team, but now you're playing men's professional football over in Europe. What's that like?
I would say it's a huge step. It's the game just shifts so much. And the youth is all about playing flat passes, short passes, a lot of tactical stuff. And I would say the lower professional or semi-professional leagues in Germany are all about physicality, long balls, headers, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think you see that in a lot of places as well. Just I feel like it's more when you make that jump from who we've talked to. It's about like you're supposed to have at that point that technical background kind of in place. Everyone's technical. Everyone's a technical player at that level. So it's what can make you stand out at that level and kind of like separate you in that way. And as you said, it's more physical attributes, more IQ, soccer IQ that becomes super important. That's awesome. So I'm just kind of curious what, so obviously as you made that jump and you've played with a lot of players, obviously, throughout your time at the youth level, and then to the professional team at Kiel, but, were there any players that you played with throughout your life that are kind of making a name for themselves now in any way, kind of maybe on the world stage, or that have signed some contracts for some bigger teams or anything like that?
Yeah, I have to say, surprisingly, there's nobody who's really in the – I don't think I've played with anybody who's now in the first Bundesliga. Okay. I got a few players who signed pro contracts, like in the second and third division. Mm-hmm. And – at the end, no, a world career, nobody did so far. I have to say, we had some good players in the under-19 Bundesliga level in my first year there. Our striker was the best scorer in the country. So
wow.
I figured he would maybe go somewhere, but I think he's now playing second league in Turkey or something. Mm. If I follow that right. So it's more about the players I can played against. I don't know if you guys know Nico Schlotterbeck.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yep.
Who just went to Dortmund. I played a couple of times against him. Yeah, and some other guys were now, but yeah. Nobody from my own team.
Yeah. Well, Bjorn, after Kiel, you ended up going to West Virginia. And that's a pretty big shift. And we'll get into the cultural aspects later in the episode. But just from a soccer perspective, what was that change like for you?
If I'm honest, I have to say the level dropped for sure. It's more youth soccer again. Mm-hmm. It's more like a lot of tactical stuff. And I mean, we play with 17 years old, and before I played with, I don't know, 33 years old.
Right. Exactly, right. Yeah.
So it's a difference again. But with our coaches, I have to say, from the practice standpoint, it's not a huge difference. Like, they pretty much practice like we did in Kiel. A lot of tactical stuff, a lot of video analysis. Yeah, looking what the next opponent is about to do and preparing for it. That's pretty much it in the season.
Yeah, I'm interested because you mentioned a lot about kind of that physicality jump that you had to take when you went to the professional level. And I think when you talk to a lot of people about college soccer, it is more of a physical game here in America especially the college aspect, a lot more long balls and stuff, but it seemed like you were pretty accustomed to that in your old team, which I feel like kind of helped your transition in that way. Would you say that kind of helped you, that kind of style?
Yeah, you could say that. I also think here I would describe physicality here with the running aspect, because in Germany no team, because you can substitute as much as you want, so the running part is insane, like how it's pressing the whole game, everybody's just running. I would describe that as a physicality stuff here, because like as you said, experienced players are more smart about the physicality, like how they use their body and stuff, but yeah, it's a lot of physicality here too, you could say that.
Right. Yeah. Well, we were talking to a Victor kid on our team at Villanova, and he was mentioning the same thing when he played in Europe as well. And he was kind of saying how there's such a tactical acumen that you don't need to be as fit, because he said you know where you have to be ahead of time. You can read the rhythm of the game, that kind of thing. Kind of along the same lines as what you're saying, where the fitness almost becomes, it's obviously still important, I'm assuming, you know, you still have to be fit, but the thinking is just at such a high level that you don't have to run as much, because you don't have to make up all, you know, these mistakes, being in the wrong spot or whatever. So it's pretty interesting that obviously you guys both were different countries, but both grew up playing in Europe, and you guys have some similar takeaways. But so you go to Kiel, you make it to the second team, and you had some ups and downs, but then you end up at West Virginia. So that's a pretty unique situation to be going from Kiel all the way to West Virginia, America. And I know you've talked to me a little bit about that, what that's been like. But for the listeners, what's that experience been like for you? You know, soccer but also away from soccer, and also if you could walk us through how that happened, how you ended up at West Virginia from Kiel.
Yeah, so as I said, I was not really happy with Kiel because I didn't play.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine told me about this opportunity in America, college soccer and stuff. Obviously we heard of that before, but it was never interesting, because when you're in the under 19 and stuff, you still think, oh, I want to go pro here, I want to try it here. And he told me about it, and I watched videos and all that stuff. And at the end, we ended up with three guys out of my team who I wanted to try it. one ended up in UConn. The one who actually wanted to do it stayed at the end at home. And I ended up at West Virginia with an agency, got some offers in, made my highlight video like everybody else, I would say. They came over, watched me play, and at the end, I flew over for a visit, looked at the school. And I would say at the end, the coaches were the guys who made the difference in going there, because I had really good conversations with them, and they made good impressions, and I still think they're crazy good coaches and good persons as well.
Right.
Yeah, that's super important, man. And I think it's something often overlooked, just the importance of that relationship that you have with the coaches. It's so important because you're going to be spending a lot of time with those coaches, especially in college soccer. And they, you got to make sure they have your back. And it sounds like they do at West Virginia for you, which is awesome. But also we're interested in just that transition in terms of coming from Germany to America, specifically like West Virginia. And kind of that's obviously a lot different just in terms of like culture and stuff. So what have you noticed as you made that transition just culturally moving from Germany to West Virginia, moving so far away from home and things like that?
Yeah, I don't know if I can say that much about the culture in West Virginia because we're like a college town and I'm just around students, I would say. I'm not really around a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, I would say in America, everybody's so nice to each other at the beginning, like always with this, hey, how are you and stuff. In Germany, everybody's just like for their own. And also how people take you here. Like you come over from overseas, my English pretty bad, but people take you, and especially in a team, I think it makes it always easier if you're in a team. You always have, from the beginning on, I don't know, 28 friends around you. Mm-hmm. And they take care of you. And I think that's what college soccer is kind of about. Because I know we always hang around with the team. We always, if we party, it's everybody's invited from the team. It's always a team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's something really special about being on a college team. I remember similar thing walking on campus when I was a freshman, and it's pretty scary. It's probably even scarier for you because at least I was coming from America, but you're coming all the way from Germany. Yeah. But it's really special to get on campus, and I was lucky. We have a great team and locker room over at Villanova, and the older guys were there waiting for me, ready to help me move in. And it makes you feel more at home. And so now you're entering your third year, correct?
Yeah.
At Virginia. And what do you think? Do you think it's starting to feel like home for you a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. It's like so far, not that many players left because of COVID. Mm-hmm. So now was the first year where actually some friends left. And next year would be even worse because even more guys leave. But I think, yeah, that's kind of the hard part about college, right? Because you make so many friends and then they go in every direction in the world. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you don't know how often you will see them again. Yeah. But yeah, no, I feel definitely home, man.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad that all worked out for you and you found a great home, I think, at West Virginia. And you said, as you just mentioned, you know, there's not a lot of guys leaving this year because of the COVID rules and stuff, which I think will benefit you guys a lot. Obviously, you guys had a very, very successful season last year, made it to the Elite Eight, and have a great core coming back, as you just mentioned. So can you talk to us about that run last year to the Elite Eight and what made that team special?
I think, first of all, we didn't have like one player who was exceptional. It was like more the whole team.
Mm-hmm.
I think the style of recruiting our coach has is more like tries to get a lot of good players in and not like 1, 2, 3, 4 amazing players. So we substitute a lot, especially in the front. So we try to bring fit players in at every point in the game. So after 20 minutes, fresh guys in and stuff. And yeah, I think most important part was our defensive shape. Like, we, but you can only say it was a back three or the goalkeeper or whatever, because how the whole team worked defensively was sometimes insane. I've never seen tens working so hard defensively, making sprints over 30 yards just to defend. And I was not used to that, to be honest. And I'm very glad they did, because it ended up how it ended up. We lack a little bit of goal scoring, but I still think how we transition from the back to the front is pretty good. And it's just sometimes the last pass or the last good touch, the last shot that missed. Otherwise, I think, or I still think we could have gone even further. Like, as you guys maybe know, we lost in a penalty shootout. So it's kind of luck then, right?
Yeah. Well, listen, you guys were one of the elite teams in college soccer this past year. Not only did you make it to the Elite Eight, which is obviously extremely impressive, but you played some top teams in the regular season. You guys beat Pitt, who's one of the top programs currently in the country. You played Georgetown penalty out. Obviously, you know, you ended up losing, but Georgetown, you know, a national champion 2 years ago, I believe, and just a program that is also is flying high, and it's a really good team, and you guys took them all the way to penalties. So I think there's no debating. You guys are one of the best teams in the country. And you guys obviously played, you know, once you make it to the Elite Eight, and also I know, like, the game against Pitt, for example, is a huge atmosphere. What was it like playing in some of these big atmosphere games in America?
It was actually so cool, because I have to be honest, in my old club, we didn't have them that often. Since we are a second team, like, everybody obviously cares more about the first team. We had a derby against our rival and their first team, and they used to play our first team, so it was still a big game. But otherwise, we didn't have these huge games, and here in college, it was, yeah, if we get the home crowd with more than 2,000 fans and stuff, it's just cool. And you see them next morning in the classroom, or see them on the streets, and they tell you, yeah, great game yesterday and stuff. Yeah, it's just a cool feeling.
Yeah,
man. No, that's awesome. I know West Virginia has one of the sickest atmospheres and stadiums that I've seen in college soccer, just like looking at videos and stuff. So I can only imagine what it is to play in that week in and week out, which is really, really cool. But yeah, so kind of moving to more personal things for you. So as we mentioned in the beginning in our intro, you're starting to get some national recognition personally. Obviously coming in at number 26 on top drawer, top 100, and number 4 ranked in the most recent USL2 player rankings. So what has that opened up for you? How does that feel to kind of get this national recognition? What do you think about all that stuff to you?
Well, it's obviously cool. I'm very grateful for it. But at the same time, I know it wouldn't be possible without a good team around me. It's the same now in the USL2, where I think currently ranked number 1 in the nation. I know that helps, like, that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I know America is a lot about this ranking and putting, like, one player out and saying, like, he's so good and rank him somewhere or whatever. And yeah, I think it just helps, right? It can just help me, but I don't want to put too much in it. I just still want to focus on my game and get better and not think that I'm already there where I want to be.
Yeah. No, that's a really mature way to approach it. And it's definitely probably part of the reason that you are getting all these accolades, is because that's how you are approaching you know, every game and every training and your mindset. But like you said, it can only help you. And so has it opened up any doors? Have you had any opportunities that have come from all this national recognition on top of you obviously being a very good player?
Yeah. You see, like, I might join some combines for some MLS or MLS Next teams this summer. But yeah, we'll see. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. That's good though, man. I really think.
get some invitations, but I'm not sure because it's like in the season and stuff. We have to see.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah. No, that's awesome, man. And best of luck with all that. I'm confident that everything's going to pan out well for you. One thing I'm interested in though too is your decision to play USL2, to play for Long Island Rough Riders. So this, I believe, is your second season now with them, correct? This season right now, right? So what kind of made you decide to play USL2? And now that you've played it for 2 years, do you think USL2, specifically Long Island Rough Riders being an elite team, I think you mentioned they're number one right now, ranked in all of USL2. So how's that contributed to your personal development as a player and stuff like that?
First of all, I think it's a great opportunity because like actually playing, I mean, you have some spring games, but they're just exhibition games and just like, what is it, 5-6 games. So like, actually playing for something in the summer and not having a break of 3 months before the fall starts has been a great opportunity. And yeah, the level is decent. There are some good college players, especially in the region. Like a lot of ACC schools send their players here. So we're playing at a very good level, I think. And yeah, it just helps. Like it's not only about staying fit, but also about playing competitive soccer.
Yeah. And I think it's a interesting and it's a very healthy dynamic at Rough Riders, like you said. There's players from all over the country and it's a competition, you know, just to get into the squad. And it's obviously a competition to get on the field. And like you said, that can only help in your drive and your desire.
Yeah, right. It might be a different playing style again. And if you're kind of stuck, it's, I don't know if that's the right word, at West Virginia, and you play like for 4 years the same playing style, might be good to get some different opinion in and some different points of coaching.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's a good environment to be in, right? I think like you always want to push yourself. I think you're a guy with pro aspirations and definitely pro potential. And like, you have to stay uncomfortable and put yourself in these situations where, you know, you're pushing yourself that's really probably the best way to reach anybody's potential. But you mentioned how the college soccer season is structured. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware, Drex, what's the new model called? The new model?
The 21st century model.
Yeah. Do you know about that, Bjorn?
Yeah, I heard about it.
Yeah. So what do you think about that?
I think if college soccer wants to stay competitive, it might have to shift in that direction because it's just such a long time from the fall season. It's, how long is it? 9 months till the season starts again?
Yeah.
It's
9 months. Without competitive or that competitive soccer, it's just some friendly games. And if you can play USL2, you play USL2 maybe. But I also know it's not possible for everybody to play it because of financial reasons or whatever it is. Like if you're not from here, you have to find housing or a spot in where you want to play. So if college soccer wants to stay competitive, I think it's the right way to go that way. Mm-hmm. But I can also not say how much it would change the whole game because, right, as I know, we might play. The season starts earlier, I think, end of summer already, or goes into summer, something like that. So probably USL2 would die from college soccer.
Right.
Like mm-hmm. College players wouldn't play it anymore, and
there are also
some negatives about it. I'm pretty sure.
That's what I was gonna say is, there's definitely pros and cons, and obviously it didn't pass the vote. Like, it got voted on, I think, last spring, and it didn't pass the vote. Drex, I don't know if you know a little bit more about it than me, but I think it's an interesting talking point. I want to talk about it for a little bit. But for the listeners and for anyone who doesn't know, Drex, could you go into the details of it?
Right, yeah. So I actually represented Villanova on a call for it with our head coach. And essentially, it's being pushed pretty heavily by the ACC and Big Ten, Maryland and North Carolina kind of leading the charge. And what it is it's basically extending the college season into the spring. So essentially you'll have two segments where kind of like a more traditional season where you'll play the first half of your season in the fall semester, have a little a break again that winter, have another preseason, and then continue on into the spring and play your college cup, as Bjarni mentioned, around May. So in the warmer weather, but also trickling into the summer, I think the college cup final would look at some point like beginning of June. So, or maybe end of May, around that timeline. So that's kind of the general overview of it. And obviously you have the pros of, you know, it's pushing to make the players miss less class. That's a big push, because you're going to have one game a week now, as opposed to two games a week, maybe three games in 10 days, something like that. It would definitely spread the games out more, miss less class, reduce the risk of injuries. Things of that nature are the pros being put forth. And then obviously the cons, as you mentioned, kind of cannibalizing USL2, as Bjarn mentioned. Other things like, you know, the draft is a big talking point, because the draft right now is slated in the winter time, when, and then the players would pick up kind of for the regular preseason with MLS teams starting in the winter, spring months. So that's a big question surrounding it, whether or not that could be possible, if players would end up just leaving their teams mid-season and then going to the MLS, kind of poses some issues in that way. And there is a lot of pushback from certain programs about it. You know, I think Notre Dame's a big program that has pushed back, and it's kind of divided from conference to conference about who's for it and who's against it. So that's kind of obviously tabled it, as Dylan mentioned, for now, but it will be voted on again. So it's super interesting. Times may be changing for college soccer. And as Bjarn mentioned, it is important to kind of do this, in my opinion, to keep up with the European model. If US soccer wants to become competitive and kind of provide this amateur route that college soccer provides and make it successful and make it competitive with European leagues, to me, it seems like a no-brainer, and it seems like something that should happen. But I don't know if you guys have any other opinions on it.
Yeah, I mean, I am totally for it. I think there's a number of issues and topics to touch on regarding that make it a really good decision. The first, to me, that I think of coming from an academy program. Basically, the academies in America have now adopted the European model, the model Bjarn, I'm sure that, you know, you're used to, which is where you train all week and then you play one, you know, on the weekend, right? So,
yeah.
Bjarn, you did that over at Kiel. Yeah, exactly. And so what that ties into is my second point, which is in that situation, there's an emphasis on development, which is super important. For those that don't know, or just, you know, haven't been part of it, and Bjarni being part of an academy in Europe and then coming to America, maybe you can touch on this after. But it's really hard to develop in the college season. It's hard to get better. And that's not because, you know, the coaches are bad. There's the coaching pool in Division I is really solid. It's every coach that has their job deserves to be there. And they're highly qualified with licenses and tactical acumen and knowledge, but it's next to impossible to develop and train at a high level when you have games every 3 days. And obviously you need your recovery in there. You have your travel. So it leads to, you know, when you get into the middle of the college season, you're kind of playing every 2 days, with like the third day being a recovery day or a lift or something like that. So I think if they move to this 21st century model, then it would give college players a chance to develop more, which is obviously something that they need if they're going to enter the draft. And we do see a shift, to be candid, of, you know, MLS teams are not participating in the draft as much. A lot of teams are just, you know, trading their picks for money, or trading it to expansion teams because they don't see a ton of players in the college pool that can contribute imminently. So I think for college soccer especially, It's really important because I think there is a pro pathway being developed, and it's almost turning into strictly through academies. When you look at like a Philly Union, an FC Dallas, they're taking players, you know, put them in the youth ranks, grow them through the academy, and then graduate them to the first team. And obviously, by no means is that wrong. I mean, that's really kind of the goal. That's kind of what America, the MLS and American soccer is trying to do. But as far as keeping college soccer relevant and allowing a pathway for college soccers to graduate to the professional ranks, I think it's super important. But Bjorn, do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I can only agree. I can touch on what you said about developing, because if you have every three days a game, you have just next day regeneration and then preparation for the next day, right? For the next game. So that's your whole week. And if you think about one game in a week, you have regeneration, so longer, even longer time to do that. And then you have 3-4 days to do something, to work on you, and then still a day for preparation for the next opponent. And it's also about the lifts you talked about in the spring. I don't know how often you guys lift, but I think we had 3 days of lifting. And in the fall, we barely lift because there's no time. Like, you can play a game, lift the next day, and play a game 2 days later again. Just not possible. You need your regeneration. So, like, it's at the moment, I feel like it's basically jacking, like, doing something for you in the spring to be ready for the fall, and basically lose a lot of it in the fall. So you go again in the spring and try to put some weight on again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's nearly to go on that, like as Dylan mentioned, it's and you're mentioning, it's nearly impossible to change your body in the fall, right? You got to come in extremely fit. You got to, it's kind of a grind, as we all know. It's put your head down and grind a lot of games, game after game, kind of no time to recover. When you do recover, it may not be as to the best of your ability. A lot of guys play through knocks all season and things like that. It's just, and you're not playing to your full potential at that point. And that's why I think for me, as I already mentioned, I think it's a great proposal and a good thing for college soccer from my perspective. And I think we all agree here, just in terms of spreading it out, allowing for development, which is the most important thing at our age still. And yeah, as Dylan mentioned, like these academies that like Philly Union and FC Dallas, as Dylan mentioned, they're moving away from the draft. And I think what college soccer is doing with this proposal is, how can we stay competitive? How can we still, because there's still a lot of quality in college soccer, as we all know, a lot of quality players, a lot of guys that deserve to be pro that maybe don't get the chance because they're playing with a knock. They don't, you know, they aren't, I don't know. There's hurdles that they have to go over that disallow them from reaching their full potential at all times. So it's super interesting. And I think it's a great, great point that you brought up, Dill.
Yeah. And also, you know, on that topic of knocks, the NCAA season in the fall, it almost becomes like a war of attrition. By the time you get to the conference tournament, by the time you get to the national tournament, it's like, who's the healthiest, mm-hmm. you know? And I think Drags mentioned it on the last episode. If you get a 3-week knock in the college season, you're missing, like, what'd you say, Drags? 25%?
25% of the season or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So imagine, like, you know, Bjorn, I mean, you imagine you roll your ankle, you sprain your ankle, and you just can't go for 3 weeks. I mean, that's West Virginia's without one of their top players for like a quarter of the season. And I think the essence of sports, I think like how every athlete should want it, and I think, you know, you guys do, it's like you want to play the other team's best players, their best version of their team, and have your best version of your team, and then may the best team win. But I think that's lost a little bit, definitely towards the tail end of college soccer. Like I said, once you get to the conference tournaments, once you get to the national tournaments, because guys are playing through injuries, like, a month in, because I believe soccer is really tough to play like 3 games a week. I mean, it's not like basketball or, you know, any other sport where, you know, maybe you can play on like a back-to-back, for example. But yeah, it's funny. Like, I was just watching the NHL playoffs, and it turned into a little bit of who's the healthiest, who can get the most guys on the ice. And it just made me think so much of college soccer. Like, a lot of the times the teams at the end of the day, at the, you know, winning their conference, winning the Natty, they're probably still, you know, the best team or deserving of their trophy, but they're also probably the healthiest. And I think if we do move to this 21st century model, we will see the quality shine through. We will see a healthy team put out by every university, playing their best players, competing against other universities' best players. And I think that's the product we're all, you know, aiming for.
Yeah. And just to add on to that, Dill, I think we're talking about, like, it's literally, what I'm trying to get at is it's so difficult for teams, as you mentioned, to really get the best version of themselves. And I'm interested because Bjarn was mentioning the rotation at West Virginia, how much they rotate players and stuff like that. And if that would, you know, that's essential in the college model as it is now, because you have to have a really deep team, because you need to keep your guys healthy. You got to keep them fresh for the big games, for the end of the season, for the conference tournament and national tournament. And I would wonder if this would like kind of shift recruiting in a way, because as Dylan mentioned, you have time to stay healthy and get your best players out more, and things of that. If you're only having one things of that nature, if you're only having one game, a week. And so I think it would change a lot in college soccer. And that just being one example of it, because you do see a lot of the most successful teams rotating a lot and putting, you know, and rotating, as Bjarn mentioned, West Virginia rotates their front line a lot, and things of that nature. And I would wonder if that would shift things a little bit. And I think it would. And I think it's better for the game, getting your quality players, as Dill mentioned, out on the field, for every game.
Yeah, that's something that I think is pretty unique with college soccer, is there's a lot of teams that maybe don't have the same quality as other teams, as like the powerhouses, but there's a real equalizer in the line shift mentality, where you can play 20 minutes and then put basically, like, I mean, as many guys as you want. You could change 11, but like a lot of teams, for example, will put on, you know, like an entirely new front line, or they'll change their center mids. So there's always fit guys. Everyone always has energy. And I think there would be a little bit more of a gap developed if we went to FIFA rules where, yeah, you're allowed 3 or 5 subs, but it's a one-time sub. And yeah, you know, obviously you play once a week, so then everyone's on the field. I think that would actually change the college landscape pretty significantly. Do you have any experience with that, Bjarni, playing in your college career, where you've seen something like that, where you know you're the better team, but it's a tough game because of the way the rules are structured?
Yeah, a lot of times, last season especially. Like, I think we pretty much beat the teams that were pretty good, like ranked teams and stuff. And out of nowhere, we tie a team that, I don't know, number 180 in the RPI or something. Like, mm-hmm. Just out of nowhere, we play 1-1 against them. That's pretty much what was it about? Yeah, last four for us.
Yeah, and you see it everywhere. I mean, it's definitely a thing, and I would say not a problem, but it's just unique about college soccer. It's a very unique thing. You don't see it a lot. Like, if you're watching soccer on TV, the professional leagues, like, it's very, very different game. And I think the outsider doesn't really understand as much as us players do. And I think it's very useful for the listeners just to get a two cents about everything that it is, and kind of what it takes to be successful at the college level. So that's awesome. I love that that point, though. Thanks for bringing that up. So Bjarn, just to finish here, we're interested in we kind of touched on it a little bit, but we're interested in just how long has it been since you've been home in Germany? As we talked about, you're playing in the summers here, in USL2, obviously you're staying in the States. How long has it been since you've been home, and what is that like for you, kind of being away from home, away from Kiel, away from Germany, for so long? So how's that been?
Yeah, normally I just go home for the winter at the moment.
Yeah.
Just for a month over Christmas. And I have to say, it's not that hard as I expected it Like at the beginning, I thought, before I came over, I thought I would go home for the summer 3 months and winter 1 month, and I wouldn't miss home that much because you're just 3 months away, gone, and then you're there for a month. So it's like basically living in both countries. But now, like, I don't miss it that much because you get so many impressions, you meet so many new people. There's barely time, like, just to think about, oh, what it's like being home right now, or think about your family. And then nowadays you get so many opportunities with FaceTime and all that stuff. So I talk to my parents, my family, my friends a lot. And yeah, I'm pretty comfortable over here in West Virginia, or now in Long Island.
Yeah. No, it's good, man. That's awesome. And I'm happy to hear that. Like you said, it's pretty unique and special, and it makes it easier to show up on campus and have 28 friends who just want the best for you right away. And it's good to hear that, you know, that's paying off and you do feel comfortable. I'm interested, Bjorn, if you had a friend in Germany, one of your buddies back home, and you guys had a week in America, he had a week in America, what would you tell him to do if he had 1 week?
Go to spring break and fall out of there.
That's amazing.
That would be amazing advice. That you're a good friend. You're a good friend for telling him that, because I think I would say the same thing. I think I'd say the same exact thing.
I would say that. Yep. I'm gonna agree. That is a very college American answer, and I love it. That is just that is perfect. That is perfect.
Yeah, no, you have been here. You do get it, Bjorn. You've been here long enough with that answer. I think that's a great answer. Well, moving on, we're gonna move on to our biggest winners and losers. This segment will touch on what's going well in the soccer world, what's not going as well. So I'll kick it off with my biggest winner. My biggest winner of the week is Hungary. And that might be surprising to a few people if they haven't been tuned in to everything going on. Understandable, because it's the international break and it's not even a real one because it's a Nations League. And if you listen to a previous episode, you know my thoughts on that. But listen, it's still a platform for these nations to compete, and especially a team like Hungary that's, I don't think they're going to be in the World Cup. So this is kind of it for them until the World Cup ends and then the next cycle begins. So it's very important. And if you look at what Hungary did over the past week, all they did is play four games, and they sit atop a group that includes Germany, Italy, and England. And how they did that is by beating England 1-0 in Hungary, tying Germany, losing to Italy in a 2-1 loss, which was a hard-fought game. And then the kicker is going to England and beating England 4-0 away. And that was just probably the biggest result from the entire international break. If you want to go into it really quick, Roman Salai scored for them in the 16th minute. Salai scored again in the 70th. Nagy scored in the 80th. John Stones got a red in the 82nd. And Gazdag scored in the 89th minute to make it a 4-0 game at the Molineux. And so for me, they're the biggest winners of the week. They ran the gauntlet, and I think they did something that no one could have anticipated. So well done, Hungary.
No, that's a great one, Dill. And I'm just thinking, like, the World Cup and the group of death, like, imagine, like, I'm just thinking, like, imagine, like, this was like a World Cup and this was like the group, and you see Hungary sitting atop with two games left, and like, it's just, it's crazy. And it's hats off to them for what they've done. And it's raised a lot of questions in England. And obviously Southgate over the years has been ridiculed for some of his decisions and results and things of that nature. But I think now, with the World Cup just being right on the horizon, a lot of questions are coming up, because if you look at that England team that they put out against Hungary when they lost 4-0, it's maybe not their first team, but it's quality all over the field, of course. I mean, they have two full 11s that they could put out that are just quality, top quality. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, it's crunch time for England, and with the heat Southgate's been getting over the years here, it's definitely questionable and something that needs to be addressed, and I'm sure he kind of got on the team and they're maybe in a better place now, but who knows what Southgate's future might be. I don't think they have time before the World Cup, but who knows after, depending on what happens in the World Cup. And this is just not the right run of form that you want going into the World Cup. So.
Yeah. And when you say, yeah, England didn't put out their first team to begin with. However, guys like Kyle Walker, John Stones, Reece James, Harry Kane were all starting. But then they subbed on. So bearing in mind that Hungary scored in the 70th minute, England did go for it at halftime. They subbed on Sterling, they subbed on Mount, they subbed on Foden. All of these substitutions were before Hungary's second goal. So by the time Hungary scored their second, it was against something resembling what could be a team at the World Cup for England. So they got a lot of questions to answer, like you said. I'm sure maybe the guys weren't taking it super seriously, but given the fact that they had just lost to Hungary, I think that's a pretty embarrassing defeat.
For sure. Yeah, completely agree. Bjarn, yeah, you wanna go next with your biggest win?
Yeah. Even though they mentioned Hungary, Germany still biggest winner. Just because of the 5-2 massive win against Italy. As you guys might know, Italy is almost like an opponent of beer for Germany. Don't have a good history with them, and leading in the game 5-0 against them and winning 5-2 at the end, I think it was one of the highest wins ever against them. So it has to be them for me.
Yeah, well, definitely. Maybe there's a little national bias there, Bjarn, but it's a great win. And like you said, it ended 5-2, but the fact that Germany was up 5-0 at a certain point in time kind of just emphasizes where the two nations are at. And Italy is another country that obviously they just missed out on the World Cup losing to North Macedonia. And that's a huge deal coming off a European championship. But listen, Germany took care of business, as the Germans do. I saw this great Mueller quote yesterday. He was Thomas Mueller, and he was talking about how in Germany they don't emphasize being a special player, but they emphasize the team. And he said, that's why you'll never see any of us winning the Ballon d'Or, but you see four stars above our crests for the four World Cups. And I thought that was super cool.
Yeah, completely agree on that. Completely agree.
That's awesome. And, you know, you mentioned it's that kind of ties into what you mentioned about Kiel, that family atmosphere too, which is cool. And something that, you know, I think characterizes German soccer. And another point on that game before I go into my biggest winner, just, you know, Italy's just traditionally, historically, a defensive minded team. You never see them getting five goals conceded. Never get. Yeah. And, you know, that just makes it more eye opening to me, that result, just because they're always defensively stout, defensively organized. And that's kind of their MO. But you didn't see it in that game. So that's a great one, Bjarni. So for my biggest winner, as soon as I saw this news, I had to give a little plug in for them. So it's going to be Tottenham for me this week. So obviously this past week, they confirmed the signing of Bissouma from Brighton. And I really love that signing for them. I think he'll be just a steadying force in that midfield. That's something that they've been missing, I think, over the years. Harry Winks is free to leave this summer. So they're kind of buying into Bantecore and Bissouma to kind of boss that midfield for them. And I think that's a great duo. And I love what Conte has been doing and what Tottenham has given Conte the realm to do this summer, allowing him to sign five players this window, which is crazy. You already saw, obviously, Bissouma this past week. You see Perisic being another signing. I think that's a great signing for them, too, to kind of give him some more attacking flair to go on with Son and Kane. And, you know, we talked about it a little bit last episode, but kind of breaking into that dominating force of Liverpool and City that we see over the last couple seasons in the Prem, making Tottenham more competitive. I think Conte can do it. I think he's a world-class manager. And now that Tottenham's kind of given the reins to make the signings he wants this summer, I would love to see them competitive. And obviously they're in the Champions League. To see them compete in that as well will be awesome.
Yeah, man. The vibes are high at Tottenham right now. I mean, firstly, you want to talk about improbably making the Champions League. I mean, Arsenal basically opened the door and mm-hmm. gave them a little ole into the spot. I mean, Arsenal blew it. And then these are really good signings. I mean, these might not be the biggest names on the market, the guys that are going to grab the headlines, but Basuma is a really good player. Perisic is, I mean, he's a champion. He's won many titles at Bayern. I'm not sure if Inter won when he was there. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. He's a World Cup semifinalist. And he's a really solid, versatile player that can play two or three different spots at a super high level for you. So, yeah, Tottenham's in a great spot, and I think that's a great shout for your winner of the week.
Yeah.
Now, moving on to losers. Oh, okay, this one for me I'm very passionate about, and I've been looking forward to this to vent. My biggest loser of the week is the World Cup, especially the 2022 edition. Or would it will go into 2023?
No, I think it's all wrapped up before Christmas or before the new year. Sorry.
Yeah. So listen, I mean, I saw something on my phone pop up a few days ago, and it was like, if the World Cup was in the summer, it would have started a few days ago. Oh, and man, when I tell you, like, my heart just sunk and I had a pit in my stomach, and I was just so mad, because the perversion of this 2022 edition of the World Cup just rubs me the wrong way, on a number of different points. Obviously, you know, it's not a politics podcast, but there's a ton of human rights violations going on with how they're setting up the World Cup over there in Qatar. But the issue for me that really, just from a soccer standpoint, just bothers me, is there's a tradition to the World Cup. It's a summer tournament. It's a time of celebration where people from all over the world gather in a place, and it's a party. Like, regardless of whether your team does well or your team doesn't do so well, it's a party for a week, and then if you do well, a month. And then the other point that I would like to make about this World Cup and the bad timing of it is this completely screwing these club seasons. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, in England, in the Prem, the Boxing Day period is one of the most festive periods, one of the most fun times, but it's also when there's a ton of games. And so now they're not going to be able to play these games, obviously, not just in England, all over Europe, during the winter because of the World Cup, and all their players are going to be at the World Cup. So it's just throwing everything kind of out of line. It's messing up the club season. It's going to feel weird to watch it in the winter. And it's my biggest loser, because the World Cup is the biggest sporting event in the world, and it's just a little off this year, and that sucks, because it's normally something you look forward to for 4 years, and then it usually lives up to the hype. So just pretty upset about it. Obviously nothing you can do, but that's my biggest loser of the week.
Yeah, I was gonna mention the same thing, or like along the same lines of just how it's gonna feel so weird with it being in the winter to me. Just so weird, and it is just so sad that it's not happening right now when it should be, unfortunately. But you know, I completely agree, Dill. That's a great shout. And you know, it is what it is. I'm still gonna enjoy it in the winter, but you know, yeah, totally. Of course, you know, it should be right now. That's the most heart-wrenching thing. So
yeah.
Bjarni, you want to go ahead with your biggest loser?
Yeah, I stick around with Italy. I have to after that loss. And also losing, it might be reason for the big loss, losing Chiellini. I think he played his last match 2 weeks ago, approximately. He was, for how long? I don't know how long. Like probably 15 years or something. The man in the defense.
He's a dinosaur, center back. Yeah.
And I think also his leadership will be missed a lot. Even though when he was sitting on the bench or whatever, around the team. He's just so much appearance. It's insane. Insanely good player. Always been.
Yeah. He's awesome. I think he's so cool because he kind of defies what you look for in a modern center back. He's not athletic. He's decent on the ball, but he's not like a ball playing center back. But I asked Mario a quote. He said, Julian, you could go to Harvard and teach a class on defending. And that's what it's all about. And like you said, Bjorn, he's even when he's not on the field, he's so important that even if he wasn't on the field, he's making an impact, just being there, his presence, his knowledge that he can give. And Italy is a big loser. They had a pretty horrendous international break as well. They picked up one win against Hungary in a hard fought game, 2-1 to Italy. And yeah, there's just not a lot going. Like if you look at their lineups that they put out, it's weird because normally when Italy puts out their first 11, they're all worldwide stars. And I can't really remember the last time Italy put out a lineup and I didn't recognize a lot of guys, you know, as someone that loves the game myself and I stay in touch with it. And yeah, like I didn't recognize a ton of people playing for Italy, and I feel like that's the problem.
It's weird, though. It's weird. It is. It's definitely changing. You know, it's that they were an aging team. The Euro Championship, everyone kind of knew that they were an aging team, and that was a big title for them, just because, you know, it might be their last, maybe they're one of their last kind of hurrahs with that group. But yeah, I mean, going forward, I agree with you. Like there's going to be some young Italian stars coming through the woodwork, but the teams that they've been putting out, I've been shaking my head or scratching my head a little bit as well. And I agree, that's a good point. But yeah, I mean, and then the Chiellini thing, I think, you know, he's going to LAFC. I'm interested to see him in MLS to end his career. Maybe chasing some money, but I like the move for him. But yeah. So for my biggest loser, to wrap us up with this segment, I would be remiss not to vent on this platform about my hometown, Baltimore, not getting a World Cup bid. So it's kind of along the same lines as Dylan's mentioning, but this is for the 2026 World Cup. So for those who don't know, they just announced the venues for the 2026 World Cup. That's going to be in the United States, Mexico, and Canada this past Thursday. And after a pretty strong bid from a combined bid between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, where the party / the big event leading up to the games would be in D.C. at the capital of the United States. I think this is the first time in I don't even know how long that the capital of a country did not get a World Cup bid, with just saying that. But so party would be there. Game would be at M&T Bank Stadium, right in my backyard. Fantastic proposition. And just it's a little bit personal, but honestly, if you look at the kind of the statistics surrounding it a little bit, like the DMV, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area has like, is just an insanely, like the soccer world has grown so much in that area over the years. And if you look at like viewership for like the Prem or for a lot of the European leagues, they set top, like DMV sits top five in all those categories. Yeah. There's so much interest in soccer. It's growing in that area. It's I feel like a great city to host. There would be a lot of, you know, hype surrounding the World Cup and surrounding the games being played there. So for me, with the personal things mixed with those kind of little statistics I just threw at you, I think it's very disappointing for me. But you know, I guess I'll have to travel to Philly or New York to see a World Cup game in 2026.
Yeah. I guess you're going to have to. Yeah. But like you said, Drags, it is a little weird. It's the nation's capital. The U.S. has 11 cities, which is the most cities between the three host countries. And it seems a little weird to exclude, the capital of the United States. With like you said, that does have a very big soccer culture. And, you know, I mean, for anyone living in America, or at least the East Coast, the DMV is definitely, a big soccer area. And I think they're going to, you know, they're going to miss out on that, which kind of blows. I was just looking at the host cities to see if there were any that I thought, you know, could be replaced. And it was tough. There, most of them are pretty good. There's a double up in Texas. Mm-hmm. There's Dallas, mm-hmm. Houston. So maybe the Houston could be replaced, you know, could have been DC.
Yeah.
You know, it is what it is. It's unfortunate. And hopefully the DMV people will be able to make it out, like you said, to Philly or New York to catch some games still.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I was looking at it too. I mean, it's tough to replace any of the cities that they put. I mean, there's a lot of buzz going around. I mean, obviously I'm on the DMV Twitter realm a lot, and there's a lot of cities like Kansas City was thrown out, Philly was thrown out. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's good what they picked. You know, I think there'll be a lot of buzz in those cities. Yeah. But you know, just kind of on a more personal level, it hurts a little bit, but it's all right.
Yeah, definitely. Hey man, we're here with you. All right. We'll make it through together. Moving on to our last segment. We're going to spin the wheel. This is predicated on the idea that you're at a game, it got delayed, or you're there early and you're sitting next to a random fan who you don't know. So we're going to spin the wheel. The five major European leagues are on this. And whatever it lands on, we're going to think of something interesting to do with that league. And we're going to talk about it for a little bit. So spinning the wheel. Okay, we got an interesting one this time. We got Ligue 1.
Ooh, wow.
I got something we could talk about real quick, and it kind of goes back to one of our earlier episodes, but I want to talk about Mbappe's rejections that he's gotten as the new sporting director of PSG. He's been rejected by, I think, three major coaches, one of them being Mourinho. He's been rejected by Haaland. He's been rejected by, I want to say, maybe one of either Salah or Mane. But really, what's important, the point that I'm going for, is he's striking out. He's striking out in this new role. And, you know, I'm not going to say I'm happy to see it, because I root for success for everyone everywhere. But it is interesting to see, because we've never seen this before, and he's not really getting all the targets that he wants. So where's it going to go from here? And yeah, I think that's something pretty interesting going on in Ligue 1 right now. Ligue 1 in France.
Yeah. No, I think, you talked about it as your biggest loser, and I think I agreed unanimously with your analysis. And I think it's good to see some rejection going around. I think it's a little bit humbling, because we both said that we don't think it's good for the sport. We don't think it's good for the game at all. So maybe a little bit of a humbling experience as he goes through this a little bit, as he took on this role in his contract. But you know, that's an interesting one. And I think that's the biggest thing going on in Ligue 1 right now. I mean, Mbappe, that's all, I feel like that's all that's talked about. With his new contract and how it's going to look. But yeah, I think it's a little bit humbling for him. And
Bjorn, are you familiar with the Mbappe contract? You know what's going on?
Yeah,
All right, so I have a question. What do you think would happen if a German club did this? Like, let's say Bayern Munich.
First of all, this would never happen. And then it would happen like the... what was it called? The Super League, they called it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like when all the fans would go against this club, it would be crazy. I think nobody would come to the game and whatever. It's like so much against German mentality. And I think, to be honest, in every other of the top five leagues, mm-hmm. it would be the same, because every club is about the club, is over every player. It was the same with Messi at Barcelona. Said they couldn't afford it, they would ruin the club. So they said the club is still more important than Messi, even though it's Messi. Mm. And I think this should always be the case, and it's almost everywhere the case, but in Paris. So
yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. No, that's good. I completely agree. I think, I don't know, was Was Bayern involved in that Super League prospective thing? They were.
Yeah, but they rejected.
Yeah, they were the one. I think they were one of the first ones to back out anyway. And I agree. It's like completely, it's completely against what I view German soccer as. And I know you know a little bit more than me, but that's going to be all for today's episode. So first I want to thank you, Bjarne, for coming on today and sharing your soccer journey with our listeners. I think everyone was able to gain some invaluable information throughout this conversation. So I appreciate you coming on. Thanks, Bjarne.
Always. Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. Of course. So for everyone else, be sure to hit that subscribe button on our show and download this episode. Also, follow us on Instagram for updates regarding postings and other things at Around the World Pod. And this link will be in our description for our Instagram. So again, thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week on Around the World.